Turn in your Bibles, if you would, please, to the book of Habakkuk. As we've been working through this series on the minor prophets, we've been trying to cover one book per week. There's 12 minor prophets, and so it's a little easier with a book like Habakkuk, which has only 3 chapters, or Jonah, which has 4, rather than something like Hosea, which has more like 13 chapters. So you don't have to buckle your pew belt quite as tight on a morning like today, but we'll still try to work through the entire book as we begin. Let's go ahead and turn to Habakkuk chapter 1, and we'll read just the first 11 verses. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and will you not hear? Or cry to you, violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. Verse 5. God speaks. Look among the nations and see. Wonder and be astounded. For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if you were told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings, not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. They all come for violence. All their faces forward. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth and take it. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their God. Enough of the tension that we might feel what Habakkuk is going to be complaining to God about. As we've looked at the minor prophets, the general or generic theme that you can put over all of them, as God has given them the theology book of Deuteronomy and calls them back to that through each prophet, is the theme of entering into the ways of your God. These are the people of God that the prophets are coming to, sometimes with a message about a different country, but they're always from the people of Israel, for the people of Israel, to the people of Israel, that God is giving these messages to. And so they're calling on God's people to enter into God's ways. You've abandoned God and His ways. So come back to God. Enter into the ways of your God, because you will experience the workings of your God, either for your benefit and your blessing, or to your detriment and your curse. So enter into God's ways. Work with God. Walk with God. That's as we work through the prophets. Each one of them says that in some different way, but all of them are saying no less than that as they preach to the people of God. When we come to the book of Habakkuk, we see that God is confronting something very, very specific with this message in particular. As he brings to them a message of judgment, he deals with one man within the culture who's a godly man. He's a prophet. He's probably of the Levitical choir, and we'll see that a little bit later. But God takes this message to quiet the fears of his people by assuring them of the goodness of his ways. And so as it's a message of judgment, as it's a hard and bitter pill to swallow, we see that God is giving them the name Habakkuk means embrace. In the Hebrew, it's related to the verb to embrace. In another sister tongue, it has reference to a garden herb that is bitter. And it seems that Habakkuk kind of embodies both. It's a bitter embrace, but it's an embrace nonetheless. And so as we look at the book of Habakkuk, this is the specific message that God's giving to his people. He's reassuring them of the goodness of his ways and calling his people to enter into them. As we get started here, one of the key aspects of the book of Habakkuk in particular is faith. Faith. What is faith? We kind of understand what faith is. Keep the faith, right? And yet, often we use words that when we don't stop and examine them just a little bit, they start to lose their meaning. We tend to take our understanding of those words for granted. Faith is at the very heart, at the very center, at the very core of the book of Habakkuk. We're going to find it in chapter 2, verse 4. The just shall live by what? By faith, by their faith. The just shall live by their faith. If we don't understand faith, we're going to miss the whole book of Habakkuk. So it's not one of those words that we can just gloss over and say, yeah, we know what that means, let's get to the good stuff. This is the good stuff, and it's very basic. And sometimes we don't take time to talk about the basic, but it's profound in its simplicity. We talk about faith, we're reminded that it's one of the five solas of the Reformation. We looked at this just a couple years ago as we celebrated the 500th year of the Reformation. Sola fide, through faith alone. But we also know that faith doesn't operate by itself. It's not isolated in its context. It always works with the at least five other solas of the Reformation, that we're saved by faith, by grace alone. We're saved through faith, by grace alone. We're saved by faith in Christ alone. And that Christ is revealed in Scripture alone. And that our salvation and this display of God's grace is for God's glory alone. And so we know that faith is operative, and while it's an essential, non-negotiable necessity in the life of a believer, it operates within a context. Context of God's glory, the context of God's person, of God's Son, the context of God's gift of gracing and giving life to those who'd rebelled and turned against Him. And all of this revealed in His Word to us. So all of these facets are coming together in one way or another within the book of Habakkuk. But the question still remains, so what is faith? It's a crucial question because it seems that what's emphasized more today, more often than not, especially in our post-Reformation Christianized culture, is not so much faith but the priority of grace, right? Grace, it's a free gift. And it is. It is. But as pendulums swing, it's not that it's totally neglected, faith is totally neglected, but as we prioritize one thing, we sometimes don't equally prioritize another, and with an overemphasis on grace, it seems that preachers for many generations now, at least, post-Reformation, have lamented the cheapening of grace. Yes, grace is free. Grace is sufficient. There's nothing that you can do to earn salvation. And your faith is in God's grace and God's graciousness to you. But when we focus solely on the freeness of grace and we don't talk about the great cost of faith, we're missing the entire point. Wait a minute, did you just say cost of faith? Absolutely. And generations before us have known that faith will cost you something. And if it doesn't cost us, it can hardly be counted faith. And so, even Paul in the book of Romans, he says, that which we see we don't hope for because we already have it. You only have hope when you don't see it, when you don't grasp it, when you don't touch it, when you don't taste it, when it's not in your grip. And so how do we know if you have hope? You have hope when you don't yet have hold of what you're hoping for. That's what faith is. And that's the cost of faith. The book of Habakkuk is written because God's people needed this biblical understanding of what faith is. That faith is something that is profound, it's robust, it's tenacious, it holds on in a white knuckle kind of way. But faith is anchored not only in the works of God, but faith is also anchored in the very character of the God who is at work. Because frankly, sometimes God's works are disturbing. And so we have to have a faith that's big enough to embrace a God whose works don't look like the candy dispensing God of the vending machine. We have to have a faith that's big enough to embrace a God whose work looks like the cross of Jesus Christ. We have to have a faith that's big enough to allow us to take up our cross and follow him, knowing that he's good even when it costs. Because while grace is free, faith is costly. And that's the point of Habakkuk as we look at that this morning. This is not going to be working for us. I want to give you a simple outline, and if we don't have this in mind, we're going to kind of miss. The structure of the book of Habakkuk is essential in order for us to get a hold of the message of the book of Habakkuk. If you'd write these down, 7 short phrases will help you give the outline for the entire book. Chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, a question is asked. How long must I wait? How long must I wait? Chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. You can put an A1 by that if you would. Indent just a little bit and we'll have B1. From chapter 1, verses 5 through 11, we have Babylon's powerful army. Babylon's powerful army. Chapter 1, verses 5 through 11. And God reveals that the army of Babylon will come and take care of judging God's people. Then indent a little bit more, we have letter C1, chapter 1, verse 12 through chapter 2, verse 1. Habakkuk asks the question, will the wicked destroy? Will the wicked destroy? God, how can the wicked destroy the righteous? Or not totally righteous, but those who are more righteous than these wicked ones. How can you do that? How can you use them to judge us? Will the wicked destroy? And then we have God's answer, chapter 2, verses 2 through 5. God says, the righteous will wait. The righteous will wait. And that's the center of the book, because that's the point of the message. Chapter 2, verses 2 through 5. Now start outdenting, if you will. Go back the other way. C2, chapter 2, verse 6 through 20, we have the wicked will be destroyed. The wicked will be destroyed. If you look up above that at C1, the question is, will the wicked destroy? And God tells them, you're going to have to wait. The righteous will wait. And then he answers that question, the wicked will be destroyed. Yes, they will destroy, but yes, they will be destroyed. B2, again, outdenting a little bit in your outline, chapter 3, verses 1 through 15, we have not Babylon's powerful army, but God's powerful army. God's powerful. And we'll see that these 13 verses are almost exactly twice as long. Twice as much attention is given to detail God's powerful army as is given to the powerful army of Babylon. And then chapter 3, verses 16 through 19, A2, I will wait. The question he asks at the beginning, how long must I wait? God answers in the middle. The righteous will wait. And Habakkuk comes down at the end and he says, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait. That's all that I can do. As we look at this book, what I want us to see is three stops on this journey of faith. Three stops on this journey of faith. What does faith look like? It looks like something that's costly. Something that's confusing. Something that's tenacious. Something that's manly. Something that's robust. Something that's big, that's tough, that's settled, that's anchoring. But it starts out with confusion. Our first stop in this journey of faith comes in chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. Faith is troubled by the activity of man. Faith is troubled by the activity of man. Habakkuk asks a question in chapter 1, verse 2. How long? How long do I have to wait? How long am I going to cry out for help and you're not going to hear me? How long am I going to cry out to you, violence, foul, and you're not going to save? How long? And he makes this accusation. He says, God, you do not hear. God, you do not save. Verse 3, God, you're idly looking at those who are evil. You're idly looking at you're doing nothing. You ever feel like God is doing nothing? You see God working in other people's lives, but you feel like in your own life, God's doing nothing. Or on a grand scale, you see Supreme Court decisions going the way of iniquity rather than the way of virtue. God, why are you doing nothing? Don't you love it when godly people say what's on your mind and you would never have the audacity to put into words? I want to, but I don't know that I could. Say, God, why are you doing nothing? But inside my heart, I feel that tension very often. I wouldn't say it. Thank God Habakkuk did. God, why are you doing nothing? And he comes down to verse 4 and 5, and he says, God, don't you see, or in the middle of verse 3, destruction and violence? They're before me. They're in my face. It's all I can see. I go into the marketplace. I go into Walmart. I go into the gas station. I go to work. I turn on the news. Every place I go, all I see are destruction and violence. That's all I see. People taking advantage of one another. People not loving each other. People exploiting. Sex trafficking. War. Politics. All I see is all that's bad. That's all I can see. And so he asks God, what's going on? Verse 4. Strife and contention, destruction and violence. This is everything that I'm living in. And because of this, God, the things that you've put into place to anchor our society, the law, yeah, it doesn't work. It's paralyzed. It's useless. It's worthless. Guess what? They had lawyers back then. So the law, when you have the law, you have lawyers to figure out how you can get around the what? Around the law, right? And that's exactly what lawyers did then, the same as they do now. God, law, yeah. Paralyzed. It can't do anything because everybody's working to get around it. So justice doesn't go forth. It's crippled. It's paralyzed. It doesn't happen. Middle of verse 4. Because the wicked surround the righteous. The idea there is you may have a righteous core. You may have those who are trying to live by justice because they're trying to live by your word. But as they try to do that, as they try to operate humbly, righteously, they're insulated by iniquity. And as they make their small efforts for gains for godliness, it has to work through the web of iniquity, and by the time it gets out there, it's worth it. It's done. There's no impact. It makes no difference whatsoever. So because the wicked surround the righteous, justice goes forth maybe, but when it does, it's perverted. The law is paralyzed and justice is perverted. God, don't you care? Why aren't you doing anything? And God answers in verse 5. So the question is, why aren't you doing anything? He says in the middle of verse 5, I am doing a work. And I'm doing it, Habakkuk, in your day. Oh, you're complaining about all that's happening right in front of you, right before your eyes. But Habakkuk, let me assure you, I am a God who is at work. Now, you've not seen it, but I'm going to invite you, verse 5, look. See, these are imperatives. Look and see. But don't just look right in front of you. I want you to have a broader perspective. Look at the nations. Because you think, Habakkuk, that life is all about only this people. Kind of had an American centrism way back in their time. It's all about us and only about us, right? He says, no. While your culture is going down the tubes, I'm doing something on the broader scale that, if I were to tell you, you wouldn't believe. Look it. Lift up your eyes to the nations and see what I'm doing. And when you see it, I want you to have this response. I want you to wonder and be astounded. Because I am doing a jaw-dropping work that doesn't fit into your paradigm. That doesn't fit into your box. I'm that kind of a God. So lift up your eyes, look at the nations, wonder, be astounded, because I am doing a work. I'm doing it right now in your days. You wouldn't believe it if I told you, but I'm going to tell you. Verse 6, I am raising up the Chaldeans. It's like, okay, tell me about your work, God. It's like, you what? This is absolutely scandalous. And for the next 6 verses, God is going to start detailing their wickedness. I am raising up a wicked people. Does that almost sound blasphemous? God, how could you? This doesn't fit. And that's exactly the response that he's going to have, but before he gets there, he says, I want you to understand I'm raising up the Chaldeans. I want you to know how bad they are. Verse 6, I'm raising them up that they might seize dwellings not their own. They're going across the breadth of the earth, and they're taking everything from everybody. You want to talk about violence? Let me talk about violence for a minute. Verse 7, justice being perverted? Yeah. Their justice comes from themselves. No law code. It's just whatever they think is right in their own eyes, that's what they're going to do. Wait a minute, God. At least we pretend that your law is supreme. They don't even pretend. Nope. And I'm raising them up. Their dignity, their honor, their glory. Yeah. Self-proclaimed. They are number one, and they'll tell you. Verse 8, they are swift to eat up other people, swift to devour. In fact, verse 9, they gather captives like sand. Verse 9, they all come for what? What was Hosea crying about back in verse 2? How long will I cry? Violence. God says, Habakkuk, you've got 2 major concerns. Justice, violence. I'm raising up an unjust, vile, violent people to do my work. Verse 11, they'll sweep by like the wind and go on. They are guilty. They're not righteous. They are guilty men whose own strength is their God. And Habakkuk, I am raising them up. Wow. You start to feel a little bit of the tension that God's prophet is feeling at this point. God, how come you're not doing anything? Oh, wait a minute. I'm doing something. Now listen, because this is often how we respond, right? But I don't like what you're doing. Did anybody ever tell God that? Okay, I have a couple honest people in here. Did anybody ever feel like telling God that? Right? I don't like what, all of our hands should be up. I don't like what you're doing. This doesn't fit my paradigm. This doesn't fit my box. God, I don't like what you're doing. Stop doing it. I'm sorry I asked. It's like going to the dentist and saying, okay, go ahead and take those pictures around my mouth. He comes back and he says, okay, we're going to have to make another appointment. Says, wait a minute. Let's take back the pictures. I didn't want to see that in the first place. Says, nope. You asked. Here's the damage. Faith is troubled by the activity of man. Faith is more troubled by the activity of God. And so he asks God, really? Not now, what are you doing, but why are you doing this? Why would you do that? Verse 12, are you not from everlasting? O Lord, my God, my Holy One. God, you're holy. You're separate. And you've been that way forever. Something's not registering in my little computer of a brain. Things are not computing. You've always been holy from forever ago. You've always been God and you've always been holy. And now you're raising up an unjust, violent, wicked nation. Did you change? Is there something different about you that I didn't know that's been hidden from eternity past? Are you not holy? He says in the middle of verse 12, O Lord, you've ordained them as a judgment. You've established them for reproof. You, verse 13, who are of purer eyes than to see evil. You who cannot look at wrong. Aren't you eternal? Aren't you holy? And he understands that God is raising up this nation for judgment, for reproof, judgment of God's people who are not living by God's law, judgment of God's people who are taking advantage of other people, judgment of God's people who are perverting justice. God, are you not pure? How can you behold evil? How can you look on wrong? Verse 13, how can you, again he uses this word, how can you idly look at traitors? How can you watch them and do nothing? You might have thought he might have learned his lesson by this point. God says, well, wait a minute, I'm doing something. Verse 13, how can you be silent when the wicked swallow up, devour those who are more righteous? No, God, we're not righteous. I get it. I've been crying to you about the violence. I've been crying to you about the injustice, the perversion. But God, we're better than them for crying out loud. And they're swallowing up us. How can you do this? Verse 14, it's like you're making all of mankind and us with them like fish for their nets. We're like animals to them. Us, who are created in your image. But we skipped over a small little phrase up in verse 12. Lord, aren't you from everlasting, my God, my Holy One? We shall not, what? We shall not die. How do I know that? Because you've sworn by yourself a covenant with your servant Abraham, that you will bring blessing to the nations through us. God, I don't get it. You're going to judge us. You're going to annihilate us. You're going to wipe us out. And yet, you're going to preserve us? This is almost a Genesis 22 moment for the prophet. I will sacrifice my son. It may be that God will give him back to me from the dead. This is a huge statement by the prophet. God, I know we're not going to die. I know we're not going to be consumed. I know we're not going to be wiped off the face of the earth. But how's this going to work? Why would you do this? Verse 15, how can you allow them to rejoice in the fact that they treat others like this? He brings all of them, verse 15, up with a hook. He drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet, and thereby he rejoices and is glad. God, he's doing a happy dance as people like fish are flopping on the deck, writhing in pain with a hook in their mouth. Have you no heart? Don't you see? Don't you know? Can't you feel? Verse 16, they sacrifice to their nets. They make offerings to their dragnets because by them he lives in luxury. By them his food is rich. God, how can you allow him to worship his own resources? How can you allow him to live in luxury? How can you allow him to eat richly? You ever look at the ungodly and wonder, God, how can they get away with it? How can they have so much while your people struggle to just get sufficient, just to get by, just to put a roof over our heads, just to put clothes on our back? How can they have so much while we have so little? This doesn't seem right. This doesn't seem fair. Verse 17, is he then to keep on emptying his net? Will he continue mercilessly killing nations forever? God, will there be no end? Will you watch him in his wickedness, defiling, degrading, destroying people, and just let them keep getting away with it? Verse 1 of chapter 2. God's spoken to me before. I'm going to wait. I'm going to stand at the watchpost. I'm going to station myself at the tower. I'm going to look out, and I'm going to see what he will say to me, what I will answer concerning my complaint. I'm going to wait now because I know God's involved, and I've got big questions, and it involves his character. It's his character that's behind all of this. I was wondering about what is God doing and why is God doing this? And so God does answer. He shows up in verse 2 of chapter 2. And the Lord answered me. And he says, write the vision. Not just see the vision, write the vision. Habakkuk, more people than you are wondering about this. How can I do this? What am I doing? Write this down because I'm going to show you something that I want you to tell others. Write the vision. I'm going to give you a perspective that's bigger than anything you can imagine. Here's my perspective, Habakkuk. I want you to understand this vision. I want you to make it plain. It's something you can see. It's something you can understand. Verse 3, this vision awaits its appointed time. It's an appointed vision with an appointed time. It's plain. It's appointed. Verse 3, it hastens to the end. It will not lie. It's true. It's plain. It's in place. It's true. It will surely come. There's no circumstances that will hold this back. It's coming like a freight train, and if you don't get out of the way, it will run over. In fact, even if you try to get out of the way, it will still run over. It's coming. But then he says, at the end of verse 3, it will surely come. It will not delay. It will not delay. How long? Forever? Wait. God says, I'm doing a work, Habakkuk. And though it seems long by your timetable, I have a different timetable. And it will not show up late. I think when Chris preached this passage before, he says, it will not show up the day after the sale. Okay. I like that phrase. God has this on his calendar, and it will happen exactly when it's supposed to happen. Oh, it's going to be ugly. It's going to be deep. It's going to be hurtful. It's going to be bad, worse than you can imagine. though not really, because he detailed some of it for us back in the book of Deuteronomy. But it's coming. And so he says, it will not delay. But look at verse 3 again. If it seems slow, do what? If the vision seems slow, wait. This is where we come to verse 4. God says to his prophet, I want you to understand, this is my perspective. I want you to see what I see. This is my plan. It's plain, it's appointed, it's true, it will come, it will not delay. Its time is appointed, but you're going to have to wait for it. But I want you to see not only my plan, but I want you to see that I can see what nobody else can see. Verse 4. Look, behold, look at this. Get this perspective. I know this. I know that his soul is puffed up. I know that his soul is not upright within him. I can see the soul of this group of people that I'm raising up for this purpose. I can see this. Okay. You think I can't see. You think I can't hear. You think I don't know. You think I don't care. I know. I can see what you can't see. I can see what's inside. I can see his very soul. Yes, it's puffed up. Yes, it's not upright. But I know that there are righteous ones. And the righteous will live by his faith. I want you to see that I can see not only the condition of their soul, but I can see the consequences that lie ahead. For the righteous, there are righteous, Habakkuk, you're one of them. The righteous will have consequences because of the condition of their soul. The righteous will live. How will they live? As a consequence of their faith. The righteous will live as a result of their faith. Not their works. A costly faith. As they have faith in a God who's at work, whose ways are good. I see consequences. I see conditions. The righteous will live by their faith in me. I see consequences also for the unrighteous. Verse 5, moreover, if this is true for the righteous, then this is even more true for the unrighteous. As the just live by faith, they live by what? By their wealth. They live by their wine. They live by their pleasures. He says, I want you to understand that I see that wine is a traitor. I want you to see that they are drunk with the deceptive drink of worldly wisdom. They're exercising their own strength. They're reveling in their own might. They're exercising their own justice. They're boasting of their own glory. They are drinking themselves to death. This is cirrhosis of the soul, if you will. God says the just, yes, they will live as a result of their faith. These will die because they are drunk with everything but truth. And so he says, look at them. Wine is a traitor. It turns them over treacherously. The arrogant man who is never at rest. The idea there, he's overconfident. He's restless. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he never has enough. He's not satisfied. He's overconfident, restless, unsatisfied, and abusive. He gathers up nations. He collects people as his own. He just uses people to benefit himself. He thinks that he's getting ahead. But let me tell you, Habakkuk, that I see the condition of his soul and I see the consequences for his choices. He will be a dead man. Let me tell you what this looks like. Verse 6. See what everybody will say. When they look on this people that I will work in their lives as well, this is what people will say. Verse 6, they will take up taunts against him. They will take up scoffings. They will hold out riddles for him. And then there's five different woes that are pronounced on this nation of the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. And the first comes in verses 6 through 8. Their loss will come upon him who violently inflicts loss. You think that they're getting away with inflicting loss on everybody else, I'm telling you, they're sowing the seeds of their own destruction. They themselves will be plundered. End of verse 7. You will be spoil for those that you have spoiled. Verse 8. Because you have plundered many nations, all remnants of the people shall plunder you. They're not getting away with anything, Habakkuk. They're setting themselves up for destruction. Verse 9, a second woe. Not only will loss come to them who violently inflict loss, but life will be required of him who mercilessly takes lives. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to keep him safely out of the reach of harm. You've devised shame for your house by cutting off, killing, inflicting death on many peoples. And because of that, you have forfeited your life. In fact, the very stones in the walls and the beams in the rafters will cry out against you. You thought you were getting away with something when you killed, you destroyed. Again, you were sowing the seeds of your own destruction. Verses 12 through 14, another woe. Glory will be revealed to him who labors to build his own glory. He starts out, verse 12, woe to him who builds a town with blood, founds a city on iniquity. Towns and cities, the places of cultural centers, the place where you gather in, you bring all the wealth of the storehouses, you put on display, you set up gardens, you create culture. He says, woe to the people who have done this, and they've made their glory the shame of others. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to them. Verse 13. Is it not from the Lord of hosts that these people labor merely for fire? They build it up so I can burn it down. These nations weary themselves for nothing. Their glory, yep, going to be wiped out. Because, I love this verse, verse 14, because the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord. They don't even know what glory is. One day I will exercise my glory, and my glory will look like their destruction. Again, Habakkuk, they're setting themselves up for destruction. And one day everybody will see it. Everybody will say it. Verse 15, another woe. This time, shame will be multiplied for him who revels in others' shame. Verse 15, woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze on their nakedness. Verse 16, drink yourself and uncover your nakedness. Uncover your uncircumcision. Uncover your defiled nakedness is the idea there. I will make you drunk. You imposed wrath, you will drink wrath. And finally, verse 18 begins the final woe. And we see that the worshippers of silent gods will be silenced before the God who will be worshipped. Verse 18, what profit is their idols? Its maker shapes it, a metal image, teacher of lies. Its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes a speechless idol. Woe to him who says to this wooden thing, awake! Who says to the silent stone, arise! Can this teach? It's overlaid with gold, it's overlaid with silver, there's no breath in it, but Yahweh, the living God, is in his temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Because they trust in created gods, God will reveal himself as the living creator of all things. Then he says, not only, Habakkuk, see my plans. See that I see what nobody else can see, the condition of the heart, the condition of their choices. See what everybody will say. I want you all to see that I sit where none other can sit. I am in my holy temple. I want you to see that. Well, while violence is exercised in the marketplace, I want you to see that I'm in my holy temple. While justice is perverted at the law bench, I want you to see that I am in my holy temple. When Babylon comes in and wipes out the Jews, I want you to see that I am in my holy temple, and all will be silent before me. The idea is that this is not just a temple, but it's a throne room. It's a place where judgment is exercised. As you come into his presence, you must be silent because a verdict is about to be rendered. It's the judge who comes in. Everybody stands, and they all sit down, and nobody says anything till the judge speaks. It's a throne room, but it's also a temple. It's a place where he will be worshipped. He will be acknowledged to be the God of the universe. Then we come to chapter 3. The first stop along our path to faith was a bit of a troubled path, a troubled faith by the activity of man. It became more complicated when that faith was troubled by the activity of God. But in chapter 3, we come to a faith that's triumphant. Not first and foremost in the activity of God, but a faith that's triumphant in the God who is active. Does that make sense? It's not just this work that troubles me. God is at work and I don't get it. It doesn't fit. But he's my God and I know that he's good. And so for a time, it doesn't work. For a time, it doesn't fit. But the end, it will be glorious. That's all I know. That's all I know. That's all I got. And so he says in chapter 3, it's kind of labeled like a psalm, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigayanoth. Again, you only find this word at the end, the Shigayanoth, in chapter 7 of the book of Psalms, verse 1. It's a song, but it's a prayer. It's a prayer of Habakkuk. Again, several psalms are listed as prayers. It's a prayer by Habakkuk the prophet. There's only three psalms in 150 that bear the name and the title of its author. That's in Psalm 18. We looked at that this morning in Sunday school. In Psalm 36, both of those are written by David, the servant of the Lord. Psalm 90 is written by Moses, the man of God. This song is written by Habakkuk, the prophet. And what we'll see is that Psalm 18, Psalm 36, and Psalm 90 all become the backdrop for which this psalm is crafted. According to Shigayanoth, it designates either a tune or a theme or a type of psalm. The ESV footnote says it's probably a lament. Perhaps it's a victory song as you look at Psalm chapter 7. We see at the very end of this song, end of verse 19, it's written for the choir master. Find it in a strange place. This is the only psalm that we find it at the end of the psalm rather than at the beginning. 55 times throughout the book of Psalms we find this inscription at the beginning, for the choir master. We see there as he closes things out, verse 19, to the choir master with stringed instruments. Hebrew says, with my stringed instruments. The idea there is Habakkuk himself was probably an instrumentalist or part of the Levitical choir who was operative in the singing in the temple. And this is supported by his familiarity with the content of numerous psalms. This part of the book has archaic language, again taken up from some of the poetry, and the fact that he has an immediate access to the choir master. He writes a psalm in response to a God who's working in a way that he doesn't quite understand. And what we see is that he says in verse 2, Lord, I've heard the report of you. I've heard about your work. I'm in awe, I fear. In the midst of these years, and the day in which I live, build your work up again. In the midst of the years, make your work known again. But as you agitate, as you exercise wrath, please remember compassion, remember mercy upon your people. And then he starts with another vision, verse 3. God comes from the south. And the verbs that are written here, there's a predominance of imperfect verbs. It has the idea of happening either now or about to happen. God comes. His brightness is, and before him goes. This is God showing up on the scene. And there's a historical nature to this theophany, as in verses 3 through 8, he recites and recounts images of the Exodus, about the plagues and the pestilences that are coming upon the peoples because God is showing up, standing and measuring the earth, shaking the nations, scattering the mountains. And so he uses this Exodus imagery, and then up in verses 8 through 15, he starts to use conquest imagery. And he says how verse 11, the sun and the moon stood still in their place as Joshua defeats the Ammonites, I believe. And they're fighting in the conquest and they're defeating different ones. And God causes heaven and earth to stand still so that his people's salvation might be accomplished. The relevant nature of this theophany is that God's army is bigger than Babylon's army. And so it takes twice the amount of space to detail the fact that God is in control. Habakkuk, I'm bringing in an army to accomplish my purposes, but I'm bigger than that army. I'm in control. I'm on my throne. And so he says in verse 16, I will quietly wait for this day of trouble to come upon the people who invade us. And then we have a response by this tired, confused, crying prophet. It's a personal response. This whole chapter, chapter 3, he says, this is a prayer of Habakkuk. This is mine. I own this. When God spoke to me, this is how I had to respond. I've heard. I'm in awe. I fear. Please, God, do it again. Do whatever you have to do to reveal your glory, to make us see you're a God who's working. But in your wrath, please have mercy. Because you've promised the just will live by our faith in you. But it's personal in that it belongs to Habakkuk. But look down at verse 18. It's personal in that it's relational. Yet I will rejoice, not in salvation, not in comfort, not in the annihilation of the enemy. I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation, because God himself is my strength. What does it mean to be a Christian? It means that regardless of the circumstances in which you find yourself, you are secure and joyful in the fact that you belong to God and God belongs to you. That's what, way back in Exodus chapter 6, what does redemption look like? God says, this is what my redemption looks like. I will take you to be mine and I will be yours. In the book of Revelation, what does redemption look like? And he will be their God and they will be his people. Okay. What does redemption look like? Redemption looks like relationship. Redemption looks like relationship. So does circumstances matter? No, as long as my relationship with God is right. That's what Christianity looks like. That's why for years, for decades, for centuries, Christianity, the Christian faith, was viewed as something that was strong. It was understood as by its ability to be silent as it endured suffering. But today, why do we have all the books on anxiety and depression? Why do we have all the Christian counseling centers? Why is there such a push to get in touch with our emotions? Is it because we're anemic and we're amateurs when it comes to faith? I think it might be. This is a personal response, but it's a prescribed response. He says, this isn't just for me. I want this to go to the choir master because this must be the response of my people, of God's people. This is the proper response for all of Judah. In fact, it's in the book because it's the proper response for you and me today when God's work doesn't look like what we want it to look like. It's a pious response. He says in verse 16, I will quietly wait. The righteous will live by their faith, which looks like waiting, back in chapter 2, verse 3. And it's this kind of waiting, this quiet kind of waiting, a non-complaining, confident kind of waiting that demonstrates what real Christians look like, what true righteousness looks like. And it's practical. He's not just trusting God in the earth-shattering, life-changing circumstances of Babylon, who's going to invade them. Look at verse 17. though the fig tree shall not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, nor produce of the olive fall, though the fields yield no food, though the flock be cut off from the fold, though there be no herd in the stalls. I'm not just talking about warfare. I'm talking about life. Even then, I will rejoice in my God. In fact, he uses these things to make my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on the high places in life. When you read through, you work through the book of Habakkuk, the message is this: when all you can see does not look good, wait to see the God who is good. When you look around you and all you can see is not good, wait to see the God who is good, because God is good and he will work a good work. Remember Romans chapter 8? Again, one of those verses we all know. Romans chapter 8, verse 28. And we know that God works all things together for those who love him, for those who are called according to his purpose. God has a purpose for you, my friend, and he's promised to work good because he is good. Do you believe that? And when you come to the end of Habakkuk, we find that his salvation is most glorious when his ways are least visible. He's doing a work, my friend, a work that he calls us to respond to. Here, the response is in two different venues. It's to pray and it's to sing. This is one of Chris's favorite passages in all of Scripture. He's preached on it many times. I've asked if he would close us in prayer as we respond to this God. Then we're going to close by singing. Singing about the fact that life is hard, but God is good. Chris, you come and lead us in prayer, and we'll sing.